This goal was ambitious, as it was more papers than I had been publishing, and there were tangible rewards attached to it. Tenure review was looming. Combined, these two properties helped the goal stoke my motivation. Discipline number two, act on the lead measures. Once you've identified a wildly important goal, you need to measure your success. In 4DX, there are two types of metrics for this purpose, lag measures and lead measures. Lag measures describe the thing you're ultimately trying to improve. For example, if your goal is to increase customer satisfaction in your bakery, then the relevant lag measure is your customer satisfaction scores. As the 4DX authors explain, the problem with lag measures is that they come too late to change your behavior. When you receive them, the performance that drove them is already in the past. Lead measures, on the other hand, measure the new behaviors that will drive success on the lag measures. In the bakery example, a good lead measure might be the number of customers who receive free samples. This is a number you can directly increase by giving out more samples. As you increase this number, your lag measures will likely eventually improve as well. In other words, lead measures turn your attention to improving the behaviors you directly control in the near future that will then have a positive impact on your long-term goals. For an individual focused on deep work, it's easy to identify the relevant lead measure. Time spent in a state of deep work dedicated toward your wildly important goal. Returning to my example, this insight had an important impact on how I directed my academic research. I used to focus on lag measures, such as papers published per year. These measures, however, lacked influence on my day-to-day behavior because there was nothing I could do in the short term that could immediately generate a noticeable change to this long-term metric. When I shifted to tracking deep work hours, suddenly these measures became relevant to my day-to-day. Every hour extra of deep work was immediately reflected in my tally. Discipline number three, keep a compelling scorecard. People play differently when they're keeping score, the 4DX authors explain. They then elaborate that when attempting to drive your team's engagement toward your organization's wildly important goal, it's important that they have a public place to record and track their lead measures. This scoreboard creates a sense of competition that drives them to focus on these measures even when other demands vie for their attention. It also provides a reinforcing source of motivation. Once the team notices their success with a lead measure, they become invested in perpetuating this performance. In the preceding discipline, I argued that for an individual focused on deep work, hours spent working deeply should be the lead measure. It follows, therefore, that the individual's scoreboard should be a physical artifact in the workspace that displays the individual's current deep work hour count. In my early experiments with 4DX, I settled on a simple but effective solution for implementing the scorecard. I took a piece of cardstock and divided it into rows, one for each week of the current semester. I then labeled each row with the dates of the week and taped it to the wall next to my computer monitor, where it couldn't be ignored. As each week progressed, I kept track of the hours spent in deep work that week with a simple tally of tick marks in that week's row. To maximize the motivation generated by this scorecard, whenever I reached an important milestone in an academic paper, i.e. solving a key proof, I would circle the tally mark corresponding to the hour where I finished the result. This served two purposes. First, it allowed me to connect at a visceral level accumulated deep work hours and tangible results. Second, it helped calibrate my expectations for how many hours of deep work were needed per result. This reality, which was larger than I first assumed, helped spur me to squeeze more such hours into each week. Discipline number four, create a cadence of accountability. The 4DX authors elaborate that the final step to help maintain a focus on lead measures is to put in place a rhythm of regular and frequent meetings of any team that owns a wildly important goal. During these meetings, the team members must confront their scoreboard, commit to specific actions to help improve the score before the next meeting, and describe what happened with the commitments they made at the last meeting. They note that this review can be condensed to only a few minutes, but it must be regular for its effect to be felt. The authors argue that it's this discipline where execution really happens. For an individual focused on his or her own deep work habit, there's likely no team to meet with, but this doesn't exempt you from the need for regular accountability. In multiple places throughout this book, I discuss and recommend the habit of a weekly review in which you make a plan for the work week ahead. See rule number 4. During my experiments with 4DX, I used a weekly review to look over my scorecard, to celebrate good weeks, help understand what led to bad weeks, and most important, figure out how to ensure a good score for the days ahead. This led me to adjust my schedule to meet the needs of my lead measure, enabling significantly more deep work than if I had avoided such reviews altogether. The 4DX framework is based on the fundamental premise that execution is more difficult than strategizing. After hundreds and hundreds of case studies, its inventors managed to isolate a few basic disciplines that seem to work particularly well in conquering this difficulty. It's no surprise, therefore, that these same disciplines can have a similar effect on your personal goal of cultivating a deep work habit. To conclude, let's return one last time to my own example. As I noted earlier, when I first embraced 4DX, I adopted the goal of publishing 5 peer-reviewed papers in the 2013-2014 academic year. This was an ambitious goal, given that I had published only 4 papers the previous year, a feat I was proud of. Throughout this 4DX experiment, the clarity of this goal, coupled with the simple but unavoidable feedback of my lead measure scorecard, pushed me to a level of depth I hadn't before achieved. In retrospect, it was not so much the intensity of my deep work periods that increased, but instead their regularity. Whereas I used to cluster my deep thinking near paper submission deadlines, the 4DX habit kept my mind concentrated throughout the full year. It ended up, I must admit, an exhausting year, especially given that I was writing this book at the same time, but it also turned out to produce a convincing endorsement for the 4DX framework. By the summer of 2014, I had 9 full papers accepted for publication, more than doubling what I had managed to accomplish in any preceding year. Be lazy. In a 2012 article written for a New York Times blog, the essayist and cartoonist Tim Kreider provided a memorable self-description. "I am not busy. I am the laziest, ambitious person I know." Kreider's distaste for frenetic work, however, was put to the test in the months leading up to the writing of his post. Here's his description of the period. "I've insidiously started, because of professional obligations, to become busy. Every morning my inbox was full of emails asking me to do things I did not want to do or presenting me with problems that I now have to solve." His solution? He fled to what he calls an undisclosed location, a place with no TV and no internet. Going online requires a bike ride to the local library, and where he could remain non-responsive to the pinprick onslaught of small obligations that seem harmless in isolation, but aggregate to serious injury to his deep work habit. "I've remembered about buttercups, stink bugs, and the stars," Kreider says about his retreat from activity. "I read, and I'm finally getting some real writing done for the first time in months." It's important for our purposes to recognize that Kreider is no Thoreau. He didn't retreat from the world of busyness to underscore a complicated social critique. His move to an undisclosed location was instead motivated by a surprising but practical insight. It made him better at his job. Here's Kreider's explanation. Idleness is not just a vacation, an indulgence, or a vice. It is as indispensable to the brain as vitamin D is to the body. And deprived of it, we suffer a mental affliction as disfiguring as rickets. It is, paradoxically, necessary to getting any work done. When Kreider talks of getting work done, of course, he's not referencing shallow tasks. For the most part, the more time you can spend immersed in shallow work, the more of it that gets accomplished. As a writer and artist, however, Kreider is instead concerned with deep work, the serious efforts that produce things the world values. These efforts, he's convinced, need the support of a mind regularly released to leisure. This strategy argues that you should follow Kreider's lead by injecting regular and substantial freedom from professional concerns into your day, providing you with the idleness paradoxically required to get deep work done. There are many ways to accomplish this goal. You could, for example, use Kreider's approach of retreating from the world of shallow tasks altogether by hiding out in an undisclosed location. But this isn't practical for most people. Instead, I want to suggest a more applicable but still quite powerful heuristic. At the end of the workday, shut down your consideration of work issues until the next morning. No after-dinner email check, no mental replays of conversations, and no scheming about how you'll handle an upcoming challenge. Shut down work thinking completely. If you need more time, then extend your workday. But once you shut down, your mind must be left free to encounter Kreider's buttercups, stink bugs, and stars. Before describing some tactics that support this strategy, I want to first explore why a shutdown will be profitable to your ability to produce valuable output. We have, of course, Tim Kreider's personal endorsement, but it's worth taking the time to also understand the science behind the value of downtime. A closer examination of this literature reveals the following three possible explanations for this value. Reason number one, downtime aids insights. Consider the following excerpt from a 2006 paper that appeared in the journal Science. The scientific literature has emphasized the benefits of conscious deliberation in decision-making for hundreds of years. The question addressed here is whether this view is justified. We hypothesize that it is not. Lurking in this bland statement is a bold claim. The authors of this study, led by the Dutch psychologist Ap Dijksterhuis, set out to prove that some decisions are better left to your unconscious mind to untangle. In other words, to actively try to work through these decisions will lead to a worse outcome than loading up the relevant information and then moving on to something else while letting the subconscious layers of your mind mull things over. Dijksterhuis's team isolated this effect by giving subjects the information needed for a complex decision regarding a car purchase. Half the subjects were told to think through the information and then make the best decision. The other half were distracted by easy puzzles after they read the information and were then put on the spot to make a decision without having had time to consciously deliberate. The distracted group ended up performing better. Observations from experiments such as this one led Dijksterhuis and his collaborators to introduce unconscious thought theory, UTT, an attempt to understand the different roles conscious and unconscious deliberation play in decision-making. At a high level, this theory proposes that for decisions that require the application of strict rules, the conscious mind must be involved. For example, if you need to do a math calculation, only your conscious mind is able to follow the precise arithmetic rules needed for correctness. On the other hand, for decisions that involve large amounts of information, and multiple vague and perhaps even conflicting constraints, your unconscious mind is well suited to tackle the issue. UTT hypothesizes that this is due to the fact that these regions of your brain have more neuronal bandwidth available, allowing them to move around more information and sift through more potential solutions than your conscious centers of thinking. Your conscious mind, according to this theory, is like a home computer on which you can run carefully written programs that return correct answers to limited problems, whereas your unconscious mind is like Google's vast data centers, in which statistical algorithms sift through terabytes of unstructured information, teasing out surprising, useful solutions to difficult questions. The implication of this line of research is that providing your conscious brain time to rest enables your unconscious mind to take a shift sorting through your most challenging professional challenges. A shutdown habit, therefore, is not necessarily reducing the amount of time you're engaged in productive work, but is instead diversifying the type of work you deploy. Reason number two. Downtime helps recharge the energy needed to work deeply. A frequently cited 2008 paper appearing in the journal Psychological Science describes a simple experiment. Subjects were split into two groups. One group was asked to take a walk on a wooded path in an arboretum near the Ann Arbor, Michigan campus where the study was conducted. The other group was sent on a walk through the bustling center of the city. Both groups were then given a concentration-sapping task called backward digit span. The core finding of the study is that the nature group performed up to 20% better on the task. The nature advantage still held the next week when the researchers brought back the same subjects and switched the locations. It wasn't the people who determined performance, but whether or not they got a chance to prepare by walking through the woods. This study, it turns out, is one of many that validate attention restoration theory, ART, which claims that spending time in nature can improve your ability to concentrate. This theory, which was first proposed in the 1980s by the University of Michigan psychologists Rachel Kaplan and Stephen Kaplan, the latter of which co-authored the 2008 study discussed here along with Mark Berman and John Ioannidis, is based on the concept of attention fatigue. To concentrate requires what ART calls directed attention. This resource is finite. If you exhaust it, you'll struggle to concentrate. For our purposes, we can think of this resource as the same thing as Baumeister's limited willpower reserves we discussed in the introduction to this rule. The 2008 study argues that walking on busy city streets requires you to use directed attention, as you must navigate complicated tasks like figuring out when to cross a street to not get run over or when to maneuver around the slow group of tourists blocking the sidewalk. After just 50 minutes of this focused navigation, the subject's store of directed attention was low. Walking through nature, by contrast, exposes you to what lead author Mark Berman calls inherently fascinating stimuli, using sunsets as an example. These stimuli invoke attention modestly, allowing focused attention mechanisms a chance to replenish. Put another way, when walking through nature, you're freed from having to direct your attention, as there are few challenges to navigate, like crowded street crossings, and experience enough interesting stimuli to keep your mind sufficiently occupied to avoid the need to actively aim your attention. This state allows your directed attention resources time to replenish. After 50 minutes of such replenishment, the subjects enjoyed a boost in their concentration. You might, of course, argue that perhaps being outside watching a sunset puts people in a good mood, and being in a good mood is what really helps performance on these tasks. But in a sadistic twist, the researchers debunked that hypothesis by repeating the experiment in the harsh Ann Arbor winter. Walking outside in brutal, cold conditions didn't put the subjects in a good mood, but they still ended up doing better on concentration tasks. What's important to our purpose is observing that the implications of ART expand beyond the benefits of nature. The core mechanism of this theory is the idea that you can restore your ability to direct your attention if you give this activity a rest. Walking in nature provides such a mental respite, but so too can any number of relaxing activities, so long as they provide similar, inherently fascinating stimuli and freedom from directed concentration. Having a casual conversation with a friend, listening to music while making dinner, playing a game with your kids, going for a run. The types of activities that will fill your time in the evening if you enforce a work shutdown play the same attention-restoring role as walking in nature. On the other hand, if you keep interrupting your evening to check and respond to email or put aside a few hours after dinner to catch up on an approaching deadline, you're robbing your directed attention centers of the uninterrupted rest they need for restoration. Even if these work dashes consume only a small amount of time, they prevent you from reaching the levels of deeper relaxation in which attention restoration can occur. Only the confidence that you're done with work until the next day can convince your brain to downshift to the level where it can begin to recharge for the next day to follow. Put another way, trying to squeeze a little more work out of your evenings might reduce your effectiveness the next day enough that you end up getting less done than if you had instead respected a shutdown. Reason number three. The work that evening downtime replaces is usually not that important. The final argument for maintaining a clear endpoint to your workday requires us to return briefly to Anders Ericsson, the inventor of deliberate practice theory. As you might recall from part one, deliberate practice is the systematic stretching of your ability for a given skill. It is the activity required to get better at something. Deep work and deliberate practice, as I've argued, overlap substantially. For our purposes here, we can use deliberate practice as a general purpose stand-in for cognitively demanding efforts. In Ericsson's seminal 1993 paper on the topic, titled The Role of Deliberate Practice in the Acquisition of Expert Performance, he dedicates a section to reviewing what the research literature reveals about an individual's capacity for cognitively demanding work. Ericsson notes that for a novice, somewhere around an hour a day of intense concentration seems to be a limit, while for experts, this number can expand to as many as 4 hours, but rarely more. One of the studies cited, for example, catalogs the practice habits of a group of elite violin players training at Berlin's Universität der Kunst. This study found the elite players average around 3.5 hours per day in a state of deliberate practice, usually separated into two distinct periods. The less accomplished players spent less time in a state of depth. The implication of these results is that your capacity for deep work in a given day is limited. If you're careful about your schedule, using, for example, the type of productivity strategies described in rule number 4, you should hit your daily deep work capacity during your work day. It follows, therefore, that by evening, you're beyond the point where you can continue to effectively work deeply. Any work you do fit into the night, therefore, won't be the type of high-value activities that really advance your career. Your efforts will instead likely be confined to low-value, shallow tasks, executed at a slow, low-energy pace. By deferring evening work, in other words, you're not missing out on much of importance. The three reasons just described support the general strategy of maintaining a strict endpoint to your workday. Let's conclude by filling in some details concerning implementation. To succeed with this strategy, you must first accept the commitment that once your workday shuts down, you cannot allow even the smallest incursion of professional concerns into your field of attention. This includes, crucially, checking email, as well as browsing work-related websites. In both cases, Even a brief intrusion of work can generate a self-reinforcing stream of distraction that impedes the shutdown advantages described earlier for a long time to follow. Most people are familiar, for example, with the experience of glancing at an alarming email on a Saturday morning, and then having its implications haunt your thoughts for the rest of the weekend. Another key commitment for succeeding with this strategy is to support your commitment by shutting down with a strict shutdown ritual that you use at the end of the workday to maximize the probability that you succeed. In more detail, this ritual should ensure that every incomplete task, goal, or project has been reviewed, and that for each you have confirmed that either 1, you have a plan you trust for its completion, or 2, it's captured in a place where it will be revisited when the time is right. The process should be an algorithm, a series of steps you always conduct one after another. When you're done, have a set phrase you say that indicates completion. To end my own ritual, I say, "Shut down complete." This final step sounds cheesy, but it provides a simple cue to your mind that it's safe to release work-related thoughts for the rest of the day. To make this suggestion more concrete, let me walk through the steps of my own shutdown ritual, which I first developed around the time I was writing my doctoral dissertation and have deployed in one form or another ever since. The first thing I do is take a final look at my email inbox to ensure that there's nothing requiring an urgent response before the day ends. The next thing I do is transfer any new tasks that are on my mind or were scribbled down earlier in the day into my official task lists. I use Google Docs for storing my task lists as I like the ability to access them from any computer, but the technology here isn't really relevant. Once I have these task lists open, I quickly skim every task in every list and then look at the next few days on my calendar. These two actions ensure that there's nothing urgent I'm forgetting or any important deadlines or appointments sneaking up on me. I have, at this point, reviewed everything that's on my professional plate. To end the ritual, I use this information to make a rough plan for the next day. Once the plan is created, I say, "Shut down complete," and my work thoughts are done for the day. The concept of a shutdown ritual might at first seem extreme, but there's a good reason for it. The Zeigarnik effect. This effect, which is named for the experimental work of the early 20th century psychologist Bluma Zeigarnik, describes the ability of incomplete tasks to dominate our attention. It tells us that if you simply stop whatever you're doing at 5 p.m. and declare, "I'm done with work until tomorrow," you'll likely struggle to keep your mind clear of professional issues, as the many obligations left unresolved in your mind will, as in Bluma Zeigarnik's experiments, keep battling for your attention throughout the evening, a battle that they'll often win. At first, this challenge might seem unresolvable. As any busy knowledge worker can attest, there are always tasks left incomplete. The idea that you can ever reach a point where all your obligations are handled is a fantasy. Fortunately, we don't need to complete a task to get it off our minds. Riding to our rescue in this matter is our friend from earlier in the rule, the psychologist Roy Baumeister, who wrote a paper with E.J. Masacampo playfully titled, "Consider It Done." In this study, the two researchers began by replicating the Zeigarnik effect in their subjects. In this case, the researchers assigned a task and then cruelly engineered interruptions, but then found that they could significantly reduce the effect's impact by asking the subjects soon after the interruption to make a plan for how they would later complete the incomplete task. To quote the paper, "Committing to a specific plan for a goal may therefore not only facilitate attainment of the goal, but may also free cognitive resources for other pursuits." The shutdown ritual described earlier leverages this tactic to battle the Zeigarnik effect. While it doesn't force you to explicitly identify a plan for every single task in your task list, a burdensome requirement, It does force you to capture every task in a common list and then review these tasks before making a plan for the next day. This ritual ensures that no task will be forgotten. Each will be reviewed daily and tackled when the time is appropriate. Your mind, in other words, is released from its duty to keep track of these obligations at every moment. Your shutdown ritual has taken over that responsibility. Shutdown rituals can become annoying, as they add an extra 10 to 15 minutes to the end of your workday, and sometimes even more, but they're necessary for reaping the rewards of systematic idleness summarized previously. From my experience, it should take a week or two before the shutdown habit sticks. That is, until your mind trusts your ritual enough to actually begin to release work-related thoughts in the evening. But once it does stick, the ritual will become a permanent fixture in your life, to the point that skipping the routine will fill you with a sense of unease. Decades of work from multiple different subfields within psychology all point toward the conclusion that regularly resting your brain improves the quality of your deep work. When you work, work hard. When you're done, be done. Your average email response time might suffer some, but you'll more than make up for this with the sheer volume of truly important work produced during the day by your refreshed ability to dive deeper than your exhausted peers. Rule number 2. Embrace boredom. To better understand how one masters the art of deep work, I suggest visiting the Knesset Yisroel Synagogue in Spring Valley, New York at 6 a.m. on a weekday morning. If you do, you'll likely find at least 20 cars in the parking lot. Inside, you'll encounter a couple dozen members of the congregation working over texts. Some might be reading silently, mouthing the words of an ancient language, while others are paired together, debating. At one end of the room, a rabbi will be leading a larger group in a discussion. This early morning gathering in Spring Valley represents just a small fraction of the hundreds of thousands of Orthodox Jews who will wake up early that morning, as they do every weekday morning, to practice a central tenet of their faith. To spend time every day studying the complex written traditions of Rabbinic Judaism. I was introduced to this world by Adam Marlin, a member of the Knesset Yisroel congregation and one of the regulars at its morning study group. As Marlin explained to me, his goal with this practice is to decipher one Talmud page each day, though he sometimes fails to make it even this far, often working with a Shavruta, study partner, to push his understanding closer to his cognitive limit. What interests me about Marlin is not his knowledge of ancient texts, but instead the type of effort required to gain this knowledge. When I interviewed him, he emphasized the mental intensity of his morning ritual. It's an extreme and serious discipline, consisting mostly of the deep work stuff you write about, he explained. I run a growing business, but this is often the hardest brain strain I do. This strain is not unique to Marlin, but is instead ingrained in the practice. As his rabbi once explained to him, you cannot consider yourself as fulfilling this daily obligation unless you have stretched to the reaches of your mental capacity. Unlike many Orthodox Jews, Marlin came late to his faith, not starting his rigorous Talmud training until his 20s. This bit of trivia proves useful to our purposes because it allows Marlin a clear before and after comparison concerning the impact of these mental calisthenics, and the results surprised him. Though Marlin was exceptionally well-educated when he began the practice, he holds 3 different Ivy League degrees, he soon met fellow adherents who had only ever attended small religious schools but could still dance intellectual circles around him. A number of these people are highly successful professionally, he explained to me. But it wasn't some fancy school that pushed their intellect higher. It became clear it was instead their daily study that started as early as the 5th grade. After a while, Marlin began to notice positive changes in his own ability to think deeply. I've recently been making more highly creative insights in my business life, he told me. I'm convinced it's related to this daily mental practice. This consistent strain has built my mental muscle over years and years. This was not the goal when I started, but it is the effect. Adam Marlin's experience underscores an important reality about deep work. The ability to concentrate intensely is a skill that must be trained. This idea might sound obvious once it's pointed out, but it represents a departure from how most people understand such matters. In my experience, it's common to treat undistracted concentration as a habit, like flossing, something that you know how to do and know is good for you, but that you've been neglecting due to a lack of motivation. This mindset is appealing because it implies you can transform your working life from distracted to focused overnight if you can simply muster enough motivation. But this understanding ignores the difficulty of focus and the hours of practice necessary to strengthen your mental muscle. The creative insights that Adam Marlin now experiences in his professional life, in other words, have little to do with a one-time decision to think deeper, and much to do with a commitment to training this ability early every morning. There is, however, an important corollary to this idea. Efforts to deepen your focus will struggle if you don't simultaneously wean your mind from a dependence on distraction. Much in the same way that athletes must take care of their bodies outside of their training sessions, you'll struggle to achieve the deepest levels of concentration if you spend the rest of your time fleeing the slightest hint of boredom. We can find evidence for this claim in the research of Clifford Nass, the late Stanford communications professor who was well known for his study of behavior in the digital age. Among other insights, Nass's research revealed that constant attention switching online has a lasting negative effect on your brain. Here's Nass summarizing these findings in a 2010 interview with NPR's Ira Flatow. So we have scales that allow us to divide up people into people who multitask all the time and people who rarely do, and the differences are remarkable. People who multitask all the time can't filter out irrelevancy. They can't manage a working memory. They're chronically distracted. They initiate much larger parts of their brain that are irrelevant to the task at hand. They're pretty much mental wrecks. At this point, Flatow asks Nass whether the chronically distracted recognize this rewiring of their brain. The people we talk with continually said, "Look, when I really have to concentrate, I turn off everything and I am laser focused." And unfortunately, they've developed habits of mind that make it impossible for them to be laser-focused. They're suckers for irrelevancy. They just can't keep on task. Once your brain has become accustomed to on-demand distraction, Nass discovered, it's hard to shake the addiction, even when you want to concentrate. To put this more concretely, if every moment of potential boredom in your life, say, having to wait 5 minutes in line or sit alone in a restaurant until a friend arrives, is relieved with a quick glance at your smartphone, then your brain has likely been rewired to a point where, like the mental wrecks in Nass's research, it's not ready for deep work, even if you regularly schedule time to practice this concentration. Rule number one taught you how to integrate deep work into your schedule and support it with routines and rituals designed to help you consistently reach the current limit of your concentration ability. Rule number two will help you significantly improve this limit. The strategies that follow are motivated by the key idea that getting the most out of your deep work habit requires training. And as clarified previously, this training must address two goals: improving your ability to concentrate intensely and overcoming your desire for distraction. These strategies cover a variety of approaches, from quarantining distraction to mastering a special form of meditation that combine to provide a practical roadmap for your journey from a mind wrecked by constant distraction and unfamiliar with concentration to an instrument that truly does deliver laser-like focus. Don't take breaks from distraction. Instead, take breaks from focus. Many assume that they can switch between a state of distraction and one of concentration as needed. But as I just argued, this assumption is optimistic. Once you're wired for distraction, you crave it. Motivated by this reality, this strategy is designed to help you rewire your brain to a configuration better suited to staying on task. Before diving into the details, let's start by considering a popular suggestion for distraction addiction that doesn't quite solve our problem. The Internet Sabbath, sometimes called a digital detox. In its basic form, this ritual asks you to put aside regular time, typically one day a week, where you refrain from network technology. In the same way that the Sabbath in the Hebrew Bible induces a period of quiet and reflection well suited to appreciate God and His works, the Internet Sabbath is meant to remind you of what you miss when you are glued to a screen. It's unclear who first introduced the Internet Sabbath concept, but credit for popularizing the idea often goes to the journalist William Powers, who promoted the practice in his 2010 reflection on technology and human happiness, Hamlet's Blackberry. As Powers later summarizes in an interview, "Do what Thoreau did, which is learn to have a little disconnectedness within the connected world. Don't run away." A lot of advice for the problem of distraction follows this general template of finding occasional time to get away from the clatter. Some put aside 1 or 2 months a year to escape these tethers. Others follow Powers' one-day-a-week advice, while others put aside 1 or 2 every day for the same purpose. All forms of this advice provide some benefit, but once we see the distraction problem in terms of brain wiring, it becomes clear that an Internet Sabbath cannot, by itself, cure a distracted brain. If you eat healthy just one day a week, you're unlikely to lose weight, as the majority of your time is still spent gorging. Similarly, if you spend just one day a week resisting distraction, you're unlikely to diminish your brain's craving for these stimuli, as most of your time is still spent giving into it. I propose an alternative to the Internet Sabbath. Instead of scheduling the occasional break from distraction so you can focus, you should instead schedule the occasional break from focus to give in to distraction. To make this suggestion more concrete, let's make the simplifying assumption that internet use is synonymous with seeking distracting stimuli. You can, of course, use the internet in a way that's focused and deep, but for a distraction addict, this is a difficult task. Similarly, let's consider working in the absence of the internet to be synonymous with more focused work. You can, of course, find ways to be distracted without a network connection, but these tend to be easier to resist. With these rough categorizations established, the strategy works as follows. Schedule in advance when you'll use the internet, and then avoid it altogether outside these times. I suggest that you keep a notepad near your computer at work. On this pad, record the next time you're allowed to use the internet. Until you arrive at that time, absolutely no network connectivity is allowed, no matter how tempting. The idea motivating this strategy is that the use of a distracting service does not, by itself, reduce your brain's ability to focus. It's instead the constant switching from low-stimuli, high-value activities to high-stimuli, low-value activities at the slightest hint of boredom or cognitive challenge that teaches your mind to never tolerate an absence of novelty. This constant switching can be understood analogously as weakening the mental muscles responsible for organizing the many sources vying for your attention. By segregating internet use, and therefore segregating distractions, you're minimizing the number of times you give in to distraction, and by doing so, you let these attention-selecting muscles strengthen. For example, if you've scheduled your next internet block 30 minutes from the current moment, and you're beginning to feel bored and crave distraction, the next 30 minutes of resistance become a session of concentration calisthenics. A full day of scheduled distraction, therefore, becomes a full day of similar mental training. While the basic idea behind this strategy is straightforward, putting it into practice can be tricky. To help you succeed, here are three important points to consider. Point number one. This strategy works even if your job requires lots of internet use and/or prompt email replies. If you're required to spend hours every day online or answer emails quickly, that's fine. This simply means that your internet blocks will be more numerous than those of someone whose job requires less connectivity. The total number or duration of your internet blocks doesn't matter nearly as much as making sure that the integrity of your offline blocks remains intact. Imagine, for example, that over a 2-hour period between meetings, you must schedule an email check every 15 minutes. Further imagine that these checks require, on average, 5 minutes. It's sufficient, therefore, to schedule an internet block every 15 minutes through this 2-hour stretch, with the rest of the time dedicated to offline blocks. In this example, you'll end up spending around 90 minutes out of this 2-hour period in a state where you're offline and actively resisting distraction. This works out to be a large amount of concentration training that's achieved without requiring you to sacrifice too much connectivity. Point number two. Regardless of how you schedule your internet blocks, you must keep the time outside these blocks absolutely free from internet use. This objective is easy to state in principle, but quickly becomes tricky in the messy reality of the standard workday. An inevitable issue you'll face when executing this strategy is realizing early on in an offline block that there's some crucial piece of information online that you need to retrieve to continue making progress on your current task. If your next internet block doesn't start for a while, you might end up stuck. The temptation in this situation is to quickly give in, look up the information, then return to your offline block. You must resist this temptation. The internet is seductive. You may think you're just retrieving a single key email from your inbox, but you'll find it hard not to glance at the other urgent messages that have recently arrived. It doesn't take many of these exceptions before your mind begins to treat the barrier between internet and offline blocks as permeable, diminishing the benefits of this strategy. It's crucial in this situation, therefore, that you don't immediately abandon an offline block, even when stuck. If it's possible, switch to another offline activity for the remainder of the current block, or perhaps even fill in this time relaxing. If this is infeasible, perhaps you need to get the current offline activity done promptly, then the correct response is to change your schedule so that your next internet block begins sooner. The key in making this change, however, is to not schedule the next internet block to occur immediately. Instead, enforce at least a 5-minute gap between the current moment and the next time you can go online. This gap is minor, so it won't excessively impede your progress, but from a behavioralist perspective, it's substantial, because it separates the sensation of wanting to go online from the reward of actually doing so. Point number three. Scheduling internet use at home as well as at work can further improve your concentration training. If you find yourself glued to a smartphone or laptop throughout your evenings and weekends, then it's likely that your behavior outside of work is undoing many of your attempts during the workday to rewire your brain, which makes little distinction between the two settings. In this case, I would suggest that you maintain the strategy of scheduling internet use even after the workday is over. To simplify matters, when scheduling internet use after work, you can allow time-sensitive communication into your offline blocks, i.e., texting with a friend to agree on where you'll meet for dinner, as well as time-sensitive information retrieval, i.e., looking up the location of the restaurant on your phone. Outside of these pragmatic exceptions, however, when in an offline block, put your phone away, ignore texts, and refrain from internet usage. As in the workplace variation of this strategy, if the internet plays a large and important role in your evening entertainment, that's fine. Schedule lots of long internet blocks. The key here isn't to avoid or even to reduce the total amount of time you spend engaging in distracting behavior, but is instead to give yourself plenty of opportunities throughout your evening to resist switching to these distractions at the slightest hint of boredom. One place where this strategy becomes particularly difficult outside work is when you're forced to wait, for example, standing in line at a store. It's crucial in these situations that if you're in an offline block, you simply gird yourself for the temporary boredom and fight through it with only the company of your thoughts. To simply wait and be bored has become a novel experience in modern life. But from the perspective of concentration training, it's incredibly valuable. To summarize, to succeed with deep work, you must rewire your brain to be comfortable resisting distracting stimuli. This doesn't mean that you have to eliminate distracting behaviors. It's sufficient that you instead eliminate the ability of such behaviors to hijack your attention. The simple strategy proposed here of scheduling internet blocks goes a long way toward helping you regain this attention autonomy. Work like Teddy Roosevelt. If you attended Harvard College during the 1876-1877 school year, you would have likely noticed a wiry, mutton-chopped, brash, and impossibly energetic freshman named Theodore Roosevelt. If you then proceeded to befriend this young man, you would have soon noticed a paradox. On the one hand, his attention might appear to be hopelessly scattered, spread over what one classmate called an amazing array of interests, a list that biographer Edmund Morris catalogues to contain boxing, wrestling, bodybuilding, dance lessons, poetry readings, and the continuation of a lifelong obsession with naturalism. Roosevelt's landlord on Winthrop Street was not pleased with her young tenant's tendency to dissect and stuff specimens in his rented room. This latter interest developed to the point that Roosevelt published his first book, The Summer Birds of the Adirondacks, in the summer after his freshman year. It was well received in the Bulletin of the Nuttall Ornithological Club, a publication, needless to say, which takes bird books quite seriously, and was good enough to lead Morris to assess Roosevelt at this young age to be one of the most knowledgeable young naturalists in the United States. To support this extracurricular exuberance, Roosevelt had to severely restrict the time left available for what should have been his primary focus, his studies at Harvard. Morris used Roosevelt's diary and letters from this period to estimate that the future president was spending no more than a quarter of the typical day studying. One might expect, therefore, that Roosevelt's grades would crater, but they didn't. He wasn't the top student in his class, but he certainly didn't struggle either. In his freshman year, he earned honor grades in 5 out of his 7 courses. The explanation for this Roosevelt paradox turns out to be his unique approach to tackling this schoolwork. Roosevelt would begin his scheduling by considering the 8 hours from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. He would then remove the time spent in recitation and classes, his athletic training, which was once a day, and lunch. The fragments that remained were then considered time dedicated exclusively to studying. As noted, these fragments didn't usually add up to a large number of total hours, but he would get the most out of them by working only on schoolwork during these periods, and doing so with a blistering intensity. The amount of time he spent at his desk was comparatively small, explained Morris, but his concentration was so intense and his reading so rapid that he could afford more time off from schoolwork than most. This strategy asks you to inject the occasional dash of Rooseveltian intensity into your own workday. In particular, identify a deep task, that is, something that requires deep work to complete, that's high on your priority list. Estimate how long you'd normally put aside for an obligation of this type, then give yourself a hard deadline that drastically reduces this time. If possible, commit publicly to the deadline. For example, by telling the person expecting the finished project when they should expect it. If this isn't possible, or if it puts your job in jeopardy, then motivate yourself by setting a countdown timer on your phone and propping it up where you can't avoid seeing it as you work. At this point, there should be only one possible way to get the deep task done in time: working with great intensity. No email breaks, no daydreaming, no Facebook browsing, no repeated trips to the coffee machine. Like Roosevelt at Harvard, attack the task with every free neuron until it gives way under your unwavering barrage of concentration. Try this experiment no more than once a week at first, giving your brain practice with intensity, but also giving it and your stress levels time to rest in between. Once you feel confident in your ability to trade concentration for completion time, increase the frequency of these Roosevelt dashes. Remember, however, to always keep your self-imposed deadlines right at the edge of feasibility. You should be able to consistently beat the buzzer, or at least be close, but to do so should require teeth-gritting concentration. The main motivation for this strategy is straightforward. Deep work requires levels of concentration well beyond where most knowledge workers are comfortable. Roosevelt dashes leverage artificial deadlines to help you systematically increase the level you can regularly achieve, providing in some sense interval training for the attention centers of your brain. An additional benefit is that these dashes are incompatible with distraction. There's no way you can give in to distraction and still make your deadlines. Therefore, every completed dash provides a session in which you're potentially bored and really want to seek more novel stimuli, but you resist. As argued in the previous strategy, the more you practice resisting such urges, the easier such resistance becomes. After a few months of deploying this strategy, your understanding of what it means to focus will likely be transformed as you reach levels of intensity stronger than anything you've experienced before. And if you're anything like a young Roosevelt, you can then repurpose the extra free time it generates toward the finer pleasures in life, like trying to impress the always discerning members of the Nuttall Ornithological Club. Meditate productively. During the 2 years I spent as a postdoctoral associate at MIT, my wife and I lived in a small but charming apartment on Pinckney Street in historic Beacon Hill. Though I lived in Boston and worked in Cambridge, the two locations were close, only a mile apart, sitting on opposite banks of the Charles River. Intent on staying fit, even during the long and dark New England winter, I decided to take advantage of this proximity by traveling between home and work, to the greatest extent possible, on foot. My routine had me walk to campus in the morning, crossing the Longfellow Bridge in all weather. The city, it turns out to my dismay, is often slow to shovel the pedestrian path after snowstorms. Around lunch, I would change into running gear and run back home on a longer path that followed the banks of the Charles, crossing at the Massachusetts Avenue Bridge. After a quick lunch and shower at home, I would typically take the subway across the river on the way back to campus, saving perhaps a third of a mile on the trek, and then walk home when the workday was done. In other words, I spent a lot of time on my feet during this period. It was this reality that led me to develop the practice that I'll now suggest you adopt in your own deep work training: productive meditation. The goal of productive meditation is to take a period in which you're occupied physically but not mentally, walking, jogging, driving, showering, and focus your attention on a single, well-defined professional problem. Depending on your profession, this problem might be outlining an article, writing a talk, making progress on a proof, or attempting to sharpen a business strategy. As in mindfulness meditation, You must continue to bring your attention back to the problem at hand when it wanders or stalls. I used to practice productive meditation in at least one of my daily Cross River treks while living in Boston, and as I improved, so did my results. I ended up, for example, working out the chapter outline